You're listening to a podcast of spurious morality.
Hello and welcome to a podcast of Spurious Morality. I'm Johnston, and with me this week, returning this week, we have Jimmy.
Hello.
And we have Greg.
Hello.
And last week we left you at the end of Androids of Tara. We'd done just over half of the key to time, two-thirds of the key to time. So today we're going to do the last third, and we're going to talk about, does it work? Does it hold up today? And we're going to talk a little bit about Romana One as well, who was a very short-lived companion, unfortunately, because she was a fantastic character. So we've got a bit to cover in this one. So it's kind of, we're finishing off the key to time, our season by season, and we're just taking a break to talk about a few things that happened throughout season 16 as well. We'll dive straight in. We'll dive straight in to the swamp, because that's where Krol is, and it's the power of Krol. It's an interesting story. Power of Krol is, I believe, they actually set out with the mission statement of, let's do Doctor Who's biggest ever monster, and Doctor Who's had big monsters before. And they didn't particularly work amazingly well. I'm thinking Invasion of the Dinosaurs. I'm thinking even the fully grown crinoid in Seeds of Doom. Not the best, most effective things. Not something that one would want to aspire to do even bigger on a Doctor Who budget. But for some reason, that's the decision we've made. Let's do the power of Krol, and Krol can be the biggest Doctor Who monster ever. And I think that's kind of the biggest flaw of this story. I think it's a story with a very unfair reputation. I think that it's a lot of people sort of see the big squid and go, yep, this one's dreadful. But actually, I think there's quite an enjoyable story in there. I think there were some great guest performances, and it does contain one of my favourite sort of Tom Bakerisms in Doctor Whoever, which is him walking into the base, seeing that it's all smashed up and an absolute tip, and just starts commenting that the cleaning lady hasn't been doing a very good job. It's so Fourth Doctor. It's absolutely wonderful. And to be honest, just those few lines completely make up for any faults in this story. It's Robert Holmes, so there's definitely a standard there that perhaps isn't there with a lot of other Doctor Who stories. I think this one has a lot to enjoy. I think there's a lot to find to enjoy in this one, but I do think you have to go and you have to find it, because otherwise it's just the one with the really bad big squid. Anyway, Jimmy, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, it's definitely one of the poorer stories of the season, but it's still pretty good. There's not really that much I found to say about it. I mean, I always keep my notes as I do my rewatches for this podcast, and my notes for this one are so short, like it's barely longer than a haiku, but that is in dot points though. So it's, I think that, first of all, the good stuff. I loved the banjo in the scene where they're being executed by the vegetation, and just the Doctor and Romana going back and forth. I think they did that really well. And I loved the point earlier in the story where they were saying something about, the machinery, the refinery, it's bringing progress. And I think it was the Doctor had the point about, you might call it progress, but what's it doing for the people out there? And that sort of, you know, it's nice that they're still making those sort of environmental points, like it's the Pertwee era. It's good that they tried to hark back to that a bit. But, yeah, for the most part, there wasn't that much more to say about it. I mean, the handling of the Swampies as primitives and that, like it's, you know, I mean, it's a bit dodgy and it's, they don't really do sort of much with it. They don't really sort of have anything to counter it. Like, you know, there's one of them who's slightly more receptive to Rom Dutt or whatever, but they're basically just generic people and it doesn't really work that well. Especially, I think the only good point about them was the bit with when Renquin died to Kroll, like just, you know, sort of parallels of, his god has killed him, it's proof that he's wrong or whatever, but they didn't really do much with it again. It just sort of happens. And the other thing I found weird at the end was when they were walking back to the TARDIS and you see that little squid and it's like, oh, yes, Kroll will have turned into a ton of little squids now. And it's like, okay, that's a bit weird. Like, I mean, if he turned into one normal squid, that makes sense. He's shrunk down, but he's, what, spawned off, like, mitosis or something into a bunch of... Yeah, it was a bit weird, but I don't know. It's, I didn't enjoy the story that much, but it's not bad. It's just, there's nothing particularly great or exceptional about it. It's just, it's there. It's, yeah, good enough, but nothing really to write home about, so to speak.
This is definitely one of those stories where characters just sort of conveniently seem to die out of nowhere when they serve no further purpose to the plot. Certainly not the worst story for this, but, you know, Rom Dutt and Renquin, both of them just kind of haven't got anything to do in the story anymore, therefore they get killed off. And the same with John Leeson's character, I think, as well, if I remember correctly, Dugin. Towards the end, just sort of, yeah, we don't need you anymore. You've kind of done your little protesty bit and now you can die and carry on. So, yeah, it seems to be a story that just kills off characters because we're done with them now. They're not needed anymore. Greg, what are your thoughts on The Power of Kroll?
Yeah, I agree with Jimmy. It's not a horrible story or anything like that. There are people that talk about it like it's one of the worst things Doctor Who ever did, and I can't reconcile that with what's on screen. But it's not particularly good either. I think it's the weakest story of the season. It's just kind of almost generic-y Doctor Who. Like, you know, this is Robert Holmes's last script for the show until Androzani, you know, five seasons later. And I don't know if he, you know, lost interest at this point or what, but the script just lacks a lot of his, like, most, you know, memorable touches. Like, I mean, the dialogue's good. Like, again, the man could write in his sleep. So, I mean, it's not... you know, bad by any means, but like you don't get like one of those, you know, classic double acts. I mean, most of like the bickering is reserved for the Doctor and Romana, which is great because it, you know, it's a slightly different portrayal of a companion, which we'll talk about, you know, Romana in a bit. But in terms of the other characters, like the supporting characters don't really stand out. Like you said, they get killed at inopportune moments for the, well, I guess opportune moments for the script, but inopportune for the storytelling, and that doesn't really work. The biggest monster ever thing, I don't think they do a horrible job of it. Like, I actually think that the scenes where you've got the, you know, the giant squid like keyed in as the horizon, you know, as the sky. Like, that, to me, I thought worked really well, but it's the close-up stuff where there's the embarrassing rubber tentacles flopping around. Like, no, like, that doesn't work. You know, if Kroll, like, ate the segment of the Key to Time, then, like, it, like, digested it or something, and it became part of it, and then it turned into little squid. Yeah, that doesn't make sense either. I don't know. I just, it, you can see like little instances of sparkle with this, but you know, you say like, this is a Robert Holmes story, and you're like, really? Like I mean, honestly, this seems more like a overambitious Bob Baker and Dave Martin story to me. You know, granted, it's not like their usual high concept thing. It's just giant squid, but it just, it's fine. It's not offensive or anything. It's just, it's kind of forgettable, honestly. I don't know why people dislike it so much. Maybe it's just because it comes after four like consistently strong stories and then we take a step down here, but it's hard to really say much more about it. It's there, it's fine, it's not great, it's the power of Kroll.
Is it arguable, do we think, that this is perhaps sort of the archetypal story of this era, this sort of late 70s, you know, the humour's in there and all the plot beats that you'd expect are in there, and there's a big monster that stretches the budget a little bit too far. And I think there is actually an argument to be made that this is who painted by numbers for 1978. Part of it.
I would agree with that. The only thing I would say is that, like, the fact that it has like a giant squid in it makes it more like a Hinchcliffe Holmes era story, where it's, you know, Doctor Who takes on a giant monster movie kind of thing. But in terms of, yeah, like you said, the humor and the tone of it, yeah, it's very much in line with certainly 15 and 16. I think 17 is kind of its own thing. But.
Yeah, definitely sort of. It's a very Graham Williams story, or Graham Williams era story. This one also, it looks a bit shoddy. You know, I think famously this is the one where sort of someone high up in the BBC sent a memo to the Doctor Who production office basically saying, this isn't good enough, it looks shoddy. You know, your sets haven't been finished, you can see the bits of wood around the metal where you've not finished painting it or cutting it out or whatever. It just looks especially cheap and nasty. And I think maybe that's part of why there isn't so much love for this story either. It's the sets aren't phenomenal, but that kind of is made up for by some pretty interesting location work. Like we haven't seen another planet like this on Doctor Who before, and haven't really again since. Sort of proper swampy type area.
The location stuff definitely gives it a slight improvement over a typical story of the era, but it's not enough to build a whole story around. But yeah, it's nice that they took the opportunity and used it when they had a story that worked for it.
Yeah, it's definitely a more interesting location for this era. I'm just trying to stretch out with some nice things to say about the Power of Kroll, but like I'm kind of with you guys. There's actually very little to say about it. It's a Doctor Who story. It's there. It's inoffensive. I do kind of like the part one cliffhanger that plays with the idea of the monster looking rubbish. Like we see the monster at the end of part one and it looks like a bloke in a suit, as do so many other Doctor Who monsters. But then it turns out that this one actually is a bloke in a suit. So fair play to Robert Holmes for that one. That is a very, very Robert Holmes kind of idea that we're sending up the idea of bad-looking monsters being a bloke in a suit.
I didn't think to make a note of that, but it was, definitely a clever move he put there of having an excuse for it. And, fair play, it was well done.
And I think that's one of the things that does make Robert Holmes so sort of special in Doctor Who. He does manage to look at it in different ways, and he does manage to sort of parody itself on occasion and all this kind of thing. Then again, this is the bloke that completely tore up the rule book about the Time Lords and wrote The Deadly Assassin. So Robert Holmes was willing to maybe add a little bit more depth into his Doctor Who stories, and perhaps this, you know, there are some examples of this here. And I think that's the Power of Kroll pretty solidly covered, to be honest. Let's move on then. Let's move on to what is, I suppose, another flawed story. Is this one just a victim of the sort of six-parter curse that seemed to be a thing at this time, where six-parters just went on too long and didn't really know what to do with the runtime, and there was a little bit too much padding and all this kind of thing? And Armageddon Factor is definitely a story that's very guilty of padding. It does have some wonderful ideas in a game, though. It does have some wonderful performances, and at the right moments, it does feel rather epic. I do have some sort of moments in this story that I genuinely like to sort of pick out, and I do enjoy. And perhaps they are few and far between, just because the story is so long and not a lot happens for the middle few episodes. But it does keep introducing new things to keep us going just slowly. Like, it gives us Drax. Drax is a great character. I kind of wish we'd had more Drax on screen. I know Big Finish has done Drax a couple of times, but more on-screen Drax would be brilliant. And we get K-9 being evil. He gets taken over by the Shadow, and then when he's untaken over and back on the side of the goodies, he sort of has to pretend to be evil for a bit longer to smuggle the Doctor and Drax in. It's got some really good cliffhangers. I do particularly like the cliffhanger at the end of part two, where the Doctor's sort of grabbed by a couple of the Shadow's minions in the transmat and taken away. Plus we have Drax shrinking the Doctor, shooting him with the gun that we don't quite know what it does. And it's another story with some absolutely great ideas, absolutely great moments. And it's arguably not too ambitious. It's a Bob and Dave story, but it doesn't seem to ask for more than the production team is capable of giving, I suppose. The idea that we're at the end of this war, where everyone is dead now and the planets are dead and it's all a total mess, and these are just kind of the last little bits of society trying to keep a war going, is a very, very, very good way of keeping the budget down. So maybe with this final joint effort, Bob and Dave actually managed to do a story that's not too much. It does have its flaws, as I've said, but I'm sure they'll be discussed further over the next few minutes. Jimmy, what do you think of the Armageddon Factor?
Yeah, I definitely didn't like this one that much. I think it had quite a bit of potential. I think it could have made a great three or four parter, but they dragged it out way too long. I mean, there's lots of good points, but there's also a heck of a lot of padding. And for me, I've got to disagree with you, unfortunately. I couldn't stand Drax. It was so irritating and such obvious padding. Like, especially, he turns up out of nowhere and then he's supposed to help. And then, oh no, he's shrunk the Doctor and himself instead of just shrinking the villain. Like, why would he even think to do that? It's just, he was one of the worst parts of the story for me. I mean, he's a bit funny, but didn't work for me. And I think the problem with the story for me was just the Shadow was not really a great parallel or opponent to the Doctor. It's just like, yeah, he's been there all along. He went to get the final segment and then he's just sat and waited all season. Like, I'll get to it a bit later if we discuss the season as a whole later in the episode, but yeah, I think they could have done more with having a worthy opponent to the Doctor and a worthy parallel to him as his rival for the Black Guardian, and the Shadow just wasn't it for me. There is a lot of good stuff, though. I'd have to agree with what you were saying about K-9, especially when he's pretending to be still the evil K-9 and he just can't act. Like, he's so, it's like, it's really hard work when an actor has to portray being a bad actor, but K-9, yeah, they absolutely blitzed that scene. I loved it. And there's a lot of other good stuff. I think the best parts for me were, I forget at one point where it was because I didn't write the whole thing in my notes, but someone basically says, oh, well, what's it matter what happens to Romana? And Tom's delivery of, well, of course it matters, just so absolutely furious. It was, yeah, one of his best line deliveries, I think, across his era. And it's nice to see how much Romana's grown on him over the season, from him being very reluctant of, oh, can't I just have K9? Don't give me some extra person. But he really does care about her, and their relationship has really developed, and that's brilliant. And again, with Romana, the other thing I like at the end was when everything's solved and she's just starts basically laying into the doctor about, oh, she's just insulting his, you know, bad points and whatever. And it's just like, it was such a good characterization. Because, like, they've grown on each other, but Romana, the whole scene of them has been very much, we're on a mission, we're getting the key to time. And here it's like the mission's over, so she can say what she really thinks, and she's a bit more sort of, I hate the way they use the term, but feisty. She's like, she's going at the doctor and she's being opinionated, and I love it. It was great to see that different side of her, and it makes me wish we could have got more with this Romana. I mean, I love Lala Ward as Romana, but I definitely prefer Mary Tam and the dynamic they had. Going back to faults of the story, though, I've got to say there's two big ones with the key to time and how it's handled in this story. And, I mean, at the end you get that bit about, oh, we're going to make a fake sixth segment and it's the right shape, so it'll work well enough. And, I mean, yeah, they have it not quite work and it has its problems, but, like, I mean, it's the same shape, so it's going to work. I mean, by that logic, any box in the universe should have the power over all space and time. I mean, yeah, it's a perfect cube, but, I mean, come on. How perfect is a cube that it can do that? It's a bit, they don't really sort of explain why it should work or why it should have these powers, and then anything being able to fill the hole just makes it seem even more silly. And the other thing with the key to time at the end is they get it at the end, they've got it all assembled, they're ready to use it, and, yeah, the Black Guardian's pretending to be the White Guardian. He wants to take it. They can't let him have it, so they dismantle the key, and it's like, hang on. The whole point in the very first episode of this season was you need to give the key to the White Guardian so that he can reset time and space and stop everything from going wrong. And they never give it to him, and he never does that. It's like you've just spent an entire season and you haven't even done what you said you were going to, and so presumably they need to do it again. And I think they did it again in Key to Time 2 or whatever in Big Finish, but it's just so silly. You've spent this whole season building up the threat. You need to do this, and then you don't follow through. It just, yeah, I mean, it didn't ruin the story or anything, so to speak, but it did definitely detract.
Like I say, I like Armageddon Factor on its own as a story, but as the conclusion to the Key to Time, the grand finale of Doctor Who's first ever season-long arc, I'm not convinced it does work, but that is something we'll get to when we talk about the arc as a whole, I guess. Greg, what are your thoughts on Armageddon Factor?
So for me, Armageddon Factor, for the first three episodes, I was watching it and I hadn't seen it in quite a while, and those first three episodes I was like, oh my god, this is my favorite story of the season, possibly. And then episodes 4 and 5 and the start of 6 happened, and then it quickly fell down around the Power of Krolls area. But if this had been a 4-episode story, I really think people would view it well, because then you don't need to put in 2 episodes worth of padding. And I think the concepts here are great. I mean, you have, you know, 2 planets that have been at war with each other for a long time, but one of them has actually been wiped out and it's just a computer directing the war. The other one's led by, you know, an obsessive military leader. And then there's also a 3rd planet in between them that's blocking signals and manipulating the two of them. Oh, and that 3rd planet is also, you know, controlled by a servant of the Black Guardian who's been, like, planning to draw the Doctor and Romana into his trap forever. And, I mean, that's all great. And it really, like, builds it up and layers it in. It introduces the mystery about Princess Astra right off the bat and, you know, really adds, you know, details and layers to that. I mean, after a while, it's screamingly obvious that she's the, you know, 6th segment. But at the same time, like, they really build that up well. you know, there's a little bit of padding in the first few parts, you know, like, oh, the bit with, you know, they're going to throw K-9 in the recycler, but like that still works. I mean, I really like the first half of this. It's just, you can cut episodes 4 and 5 and almost not lose anything. I mean, you know, Drax is fun. Like, he's funny. Like, you know, he's enjoyable when he's on screen to me, but he is completely extraneous. Like, you can cut him and you lose nothing other than that performance. Like, you don't, you know, you're like, oh, it's an old school friend of the Doctor's. And it's like, oh, well, maybe we'll learn something about, and other than, you know, apparently someone at least called him Theta Sigma. You don't really do anything with that idea. It's just very odd. Like, there's just another Time Lord there, just at random. Like, that is bizarre to me. And it just doesn't, it's so obviously there to drag the story out. And there's so much, you know, teleporting between Atreus and Zeos and the shadow planet. And it's just like, oh my, like it just grinds to a halt. And those two episodes 4 and 5, it just like, it's just so tedious. It, like the, you get the feeling that you yourself are stuck in the Marshall's time loop because it's just the same stuff happening over and over again. And yeah, it by the end, it's just like, I want this to end. Now, I like the very end where it resolves the Key to Time story, although I agree, and we'll talk about this in a bit too, but that it, you know, doesn't really resolve the story. But I like the Black Guardian and, you know, Doctor, you shall die for this, which of course we'll see again. And yeah, I mean, that's fine. I honestly do believe that if this was with, you know, necessary edits, if the story was episodes 1 through 3 and then 6, I don't know if we would call it a classic per se, but it would certainly be well regarded, just like the majority of season 16. I think, and also like as a, you know, Bob Baker and Dave Martin script, and as their last one together, it's like those concepts I described are really neat concepts. And for once, they've actually come up with concepts that can be realized on screen realistically in their budget. So that's, you know, good job, guys. It took you 10 years, but you figured it out. And then and this is it. So anyway, I wish I liked it more, because those first 3 episodes really had me excited on rewatch, and I never expected that.
There definitely is. As I said, when I said this about Power of Crawl, there definitely is an awful lot to pick out to enjoy with this one. And I agree with you, the first half is a lot stronger than the second half, because everything is kind of revealed by the end of part 3. We've very little to learn after that point. And we do literally sit in a time loop. Like, it takes the Marshall, a very interesting character, very, very well played character, and sticks him in a time loop for half a story, and it doesn't particularly work. I think the worst part of padding in this, though, we've not mentioned it yet, but there are scenes of just communication between Mentalis and K-9, and it's literally two computers just beeping at each other, and it feels like these scenes go on for the entirety of an episode. And it is just beep, 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 beep. That's all it is. But yeah, I've no real problem with the Armageddon factor. It's not the first time a six-parter has... Well, it's not the first time six parts has been too long for the story that it's trying to tell. And you can see why... Yes, we've got Sharda. There was supposed to be another six-parter, and it has been, but this was the last one for quite a long time. In terms of, you know, if you were watching this in the 70s, and I can see why they sort of knocked the whole idea of longer stories on the head. And then when they eventually did decide to do a longer story, they got Robert Holmes back to do it because he knew how to do it way back when. And then you look at it, and he didn't actually do that many six-parters, all things considered. But the ones that he did do were still rather excellent. So that was season 16. That was the key to time. We've completed it, and then snapped the tracer in half and scattered it back into the vortex. Key to time, then, as a whole, as a story arc that lasted a whole season. This is quite ambitious for Doctor Who. This is not like anything we've sort of seen so far in season by season. We've had long stories that have switched location and ideas and had multiple villains, you know, the Daleks' master plan and the War Games spring to mind. But this is the first time we've attempted to tell a whole story over a series, and that every single serial in the series has somewhat contributed to the overall storyline. It's really common now. You know, TV is essentially a serialized thing nowadays. Most top-tier television is serialized. It's one continuous story or various story arcs floating through the series. Doctor Who has done season-long stories a few times since this, with, I'd say, varying results. But I think that there's definitely something unique about the key to time with Doctor Who, because at the end of the day, it is just a traditional season of Doctor Who. The key to time, it's quite background. It's quite limited, the impact it actually has. You know, the Rebus operation is its own story, the pirate planet is its own story, and so on. The key to time is just kind of floating in the background, which kind of makes you think that we're heading towards a big sort of showdown between the Doctor and the Black Guardian, as was set up at the start of the season. And actually, the Black Guardian gets a total of, 3 minutes screen time at the very, very end. It's a slightly odd way to do it. As we've all sort of commented, Armageddon Factor, or particularly the way it ends, isn't necessarily how you'd expect or even want a story like The Key to Time to conclude. Armageddon Factor, for the most part, is interested in telling its own story and not wrapping up this season-long storyline. And I believe that sort of the last bit of the last episode wasn't written by Bob and Dave. I think it was it Douglas Adams, actually, that wrote the sort of final bit? Was it his first thing in the role of script editor? I'm not sure, no, but I'm not convinced it works. I'm convinced that as a storyline it works, and I think it's a great season of Doctor Who. I think that the fact that most of the serials are excellent and the couple that aren't excellent at least have a lot to enjoy. They're not actively bad. But like, as a whole, The Key to Time, does that story need to be there? Would it alter anything else in the season at all, if it were removed, I guess? So I'm sounding really down on it. I love The Key to Time, but I think I love The Key to Time because the stories are so good, not because the overwriting story is so good, the arc. So Jimmy, kind of what are your thoughts on The Key to Time as a story arc, as a season? Go ahead.
I think, as you say, the thing is, for most of the stories, it didn't really matter. I mean, the story stands on its own, and the key is just something that's thrown in that they've got to get. I mean, I think the story that exemplifies that the most has got to be Tara, where Romana finds the key in about 2 minutes into episode one, and then she gets captured and the whole rest of the plot happens. It's I think it's a bit of a shame that it was a good season for the most part and lots of good stories, but I don't think the actual arc side of it really worked that well overall. I mean, I think the thing with the arc is the dynamic worked well between the Doctor and Romana. And as I said in this episode, I loved Romana at the end when you got to see the glimpse of what she'd be like without that dynamic. Overall, I think it was just, you never got that sense of, oh, someone else is out there and trying to get the key. And I mean, they covered it pretty well with that whole, oh, I just went straight for the last key segment and you did all the work for me, thanks. But I think it could have been a lot better if they'd, you know, played with the dynamic more and maybe, you know, instead of getting this generic shadow figure who only pops up in the last story, like if they'd had someone, like maybe they could have used Master or whatever, but have someone appear who is working for Blackguard and is their rival trying to get the key and, you know, build this dynamic across the whole season. But, yeah, I think it was basically all the arc-heavy stuff was like in the first episode of Ryboss or the last episode of Armageddon Factor, and most of the season it really didn't have as much of an impact as it could or should. Yeah, I mean, as I say, I liked the season overall and I enjoyed it, but I think there's, yeah, sadly, the idea had a lot more potential than actually got used in the end, and I think that was a bit of a shame.
Yeah, it's definitely a great idea, but it's missing that consistent villain throughout, and I'm absolutely fine with the Black Guardian not showing up until the last 5 minutes. That doesn't matter, you know, the White Guardian's only there for the first 5 minutes of Reboss. But we are missing that connective tissue in terms of a character. You know, we could have had, I mean, the Master, you mentioned the Master, it's obvious, maybe a little bit too obvious, but this would have been a perfect point to bring back the Master. And let's face it, the Master from the Deadly Assassin and the Shadow are not too far apart in terms of design, speech patterns even. It definitely could have worked. Also, the Master getting stuck in and messing about with the war between Atreus and Zeos, that's definitely the sort of thing he'd do. That's definitely a Mastery plot. But I think that, well, I suppose I keep saying that this is Doctor Who's first story arc, but I guess we've got the Master in season 8, you know, sort of 5 unconnected stories, but the Master is in all of them. We could have had something like that here, and he could even have, you know, only popped up for a few minutes in Android's Atara or something like that. You know, he didn't have to have a massive part. Think about, let's say, the Headhunter in the first series of Eighth Doctor and Lucy Miller. She just pops up, like there's something going on, and then she's kind of explained in the finale a bit better. She's a main character in the finale. It could have been something like that. Also, we've got this idea that the sixth piece of the Key to Time is the sixth piece, the final piece. Like, do these pieces actually go in order? Like, was the first piece collected by the Doctor and Romana very specifically piece number one? Like, the idea that the Shadow has jumped forward to the end to piece number six, like, how did he know that would be the sixth one the Doctor and Romana got to? Is there some order that these segments go in? Is there any reason for that? Because the only thing that identifies it as the six pieces is the sixth one that the Doctor and Romana get to. But we get all of the six princess of the six house of the six dynasty with Astra. And like, why does the number six become so significant? You know, why wasn't the number four really significant in Tara or three in Stones of Blood? So it feels as though it's got the foundations of a really, really good story arc, but they're not all necessarily there. Like, the building's not there, the structure's not there. Greg, what about you?
That's actually a really interesting point about the numbered segments of The Key to Time. I never thought about it that way, but that's absolutely true. Why is this one the sixth segment and not just one of six segments? Ultimately, the story arc is really just used as a driving narrative factor in the season. Like, it's just, for the most part, it's just the reason why they go to these planets. You could tell all of these stories except Armageddon Factor with the Doctor just landing on a random planet. And you could do exactly the same thing and not have the Key to Time bit in it, and it would be fine. You could also do Armageddon Factor if you rewrote it pretty heavily. But so for most of the season, it doesn't really matter. It's just kind of a thing that's there in the background, and it gives them, like, you know, narrative momentum. It gives them something to do. But otherwise, I just don't think there's very much significance to it. It's clearly not thought out at all. They don't have any legitimate plot architecture going on. The things you learn about the key are inconsistent from episode to episode. It doesn't work especially well. And then there's the whole issue that Jimmy brought up earlier, which was that at the very top of it, they tell you they need the key to time because the White Guardian has to stop time for a brief second and, you know, set things back in motion, or else the universe will be destroyed or plunge into chaos or something. And then that doesn't happen. Like, the entire motivation for the search for the key to time is disregarded. Now, I mean, I've seen it argued that, okay, really it was the White Guardian was never there. It was always the Black Guardian in disguise. The universe doesn't need to be paused. And like, yeah, that works just fine as an explanation, but there's absolutely none of that in the stories. Like, that's not on screen. That's just headcanon. And yeah, it's sloppy. It almost feels like it was started by different people than finished it, almost, because by the end they're just like, oh god, what do we do? And then, you know, you get the randomness of Armageddon factor, and I don't think it adds anything, honestly. It's cool that, oh, this is the search for the key to time, but it's really insignificant. I mean, as a season long plot, like, there's no serialization to it at all. It's just there. And yeah, I ultimately agree with your summing up of it, which is that I like this season. It's a very strong season on average, but the fact that it's the search for the key to time really doesn't have anything to do with that.
Just going back to your, you know, what you suggested there about the theory that it was the Black Guardian all along and the White Guardian wasn't involved. Why does he appear as the White Guardian at the start of Rebos, but then the Black Guardian with a white suit on at the end of Armageddon Factor? It kind of doesn't work, does it? So yeah, it's odd.
Like I said, it's not on screen at all. I've seen people use that as a headcanon explanation. So there you
yeah.
go.
If it was Valentin Dial in Rebos, then yeah, I'd be all over that. It's a great idea. In fact, you could even argue they showed it instead of telling it, which is absolutely fine, but that's not what they did. And you're right, it's just a case of they've not really thought it out. They've just sort of come up with an idea that's nice, and, you know, obviously they were thinking about the very, very pretty DVD box set that would be released 30 years later, and that's about it. But yeah, it has its flaws as a storyline, but the fact that the stories are generally so good here, it makes up for it without any sort of question. And, you know, it does allow for things like the Megara and, you know, the Seal of Diplos, and it does allow for, you know, some interesting ideas to be in there. Like, again, you know, one segment is an entire planet, one segment is a person. It's interesting. These are big, interesting ideas, things that Doctor Who should be exploring. And I'm kind of glad that we have that, and maybe wouldn't have got those just brilliant little moments without the idea of the key to time being there. And it also conveniently gave us an excuse to have a very, very, very different companion to anything we've, arguably anything we've had before, but certainly anything we've had for a long, long time. Which kind of brings us on to our final topic of discussion in this episode. Romana, Mary Tam's Romana, the first Romana, absolutely brilliant character, brilliant companion. I love the idea that she starts off as this sort of very, very, very intelligent, but very, very, very naive character. And she does grow throughout the season. It's apparently Mary Tam wasn't really happy because she felt there was a lack of development with Romana. But I genuinely think, actually, we have a companion here who is genuinely different in her final episode to how she was in her first and has grown throughout the season. It's a real shame she's a one-season companion, because I do think that there was still room for development and movement, and the sort of rapport that the Doctor and the First Romana have is, it's a very, very unique companion relationship, Doctor-companion relationship. Even, you know, the second Romana, who is a bit more adventurous and that kind of thing, you know, she won't boast that she's clever in the Doctor or she's done something better than the Doctor. She'll just kind of smile and go, oh, well, I'm brilliant, aren't I? I think we've got a really, really unique companion here. And it's in some ways a shame that she's kind of bound to the story arc that is The Key to Time. So, Jimmy, any words on the first Romana, on Romana 1?
Yeah, I absolutely think she was a brilliant companion, and I think it's a real shame that this was her only season and, you know, she regenerates basically in a side room off screen. It's, your point about the actress having preferred that things being different and thinking there wasn't much development, it's a pity because I think you definitely can see the development, and as I said earlier, it shines through in that final bit where, you know, the crisis averted, the key's been done with, and Romana just sort of can open up a bit more and be herself and be a bit more harsh with the Doctor and less just, you know, we've got a mission, we've got to do what we've got to do. And I think if Mary Tam had stayed an extra season, that there would have definitely been a chance to shine a different light on their dynamic, and it could have been amazing. And it's something that frustrates me often with the extended universe stories, like whether in the books or some of the companion chronicles, it's like with Mary Tam Romana stories, they'd have an excuse like, oh, we're searching for the key to time, but the tracer accidentally sent us to this planet instead because of whatever signal that seemed like a key. And it's like, why are you wasting time making excuses to slot into a gap where there's really no logical room for it when there's this huge unexplored thing of what the first Romana would have been like after The Key to Time and before she turned into Lala Ward's incarnation. And I think it's a shame that that hasn't been explored more in the extended universe. And I mean, I know some people will say, oh, but when she regenerated, they thought she was Astra, and so that proves the stories are right after each other. But if anything, for me, it works better if it's been a longer time, because I mean, if it was happening straight after they'd been on Astra, then the Doctor wouldn't be too surprised to see the princess having stowed away or whatever. But if it's been like, you know, years, decades, and they've gone through a whole bunch of other stuff and Astra's popped up again out of nowhere, then his reaction would make more sense. So, I mean, I think there's a huge gap there, and it's a shame it's so unexplored. And especially that in the audios, I mean, we did get that one season of audios with Tom's Doctor and Mary's Romana, but I think there was a lot of potential there and a lot of it didn't get explored, and I think it would have been amazing to see it explored. And so, yeah, it's a shame that the potential wasn't fully reached by Mary's incarnation, but I still think she's brilliant as she is and as the character was. I mean, I think I'd argue she's my favourite Tom Baker companion, really. And so, yeah, it's a pity we didn't get more of her, but it's great that we got what we did and that she was so brilliant in what she did do.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of unexplored potential, and I'll be forever grateful that we did get that one season before, you know, we sadly lost Mary Tam, because her and Tom Baker are just great. I will never get tired of listening to that second series of Fourth Doctor Adventures from Big Finish, because it just gives us the sort of second Romana one season that I think everybody would say they wanted. She did do some great stuff in Gallifrey as well, the Gallifrey series, Big Finish. So there's definitely extra stuff out there. But
that was great hearing her as the Pandora in the Gallifrey audios. I think, yeah, it's absolutely brilliant that she returned for that. And yeah, great to see a completely different side of the actress as a character, rather than being Romana as being this sort of evil shadow version that's not really Romana, it just looks like her. Yes, so once again, some more brilliant work from Mary there.
Yeah, I do think we're incredibly lucky to have that stuff, and it is a shame there isn't more. Greg, your thoughts on the first Romana?
I think she's great. I like the character a lot. I mean, you guys have been talking about this quite a bit, but like I like the fact that we have a companion here who is A, unafraid to challenge the Doctor, and B, on his level. Like I love how Tom Baker plays it, where, you know, he's like a little frustrated that she keeps challenging him, but also that she's right a lot of the time. And like he starts out being just like irritated with her and hostile towards her, but as the season progresses, like he becomes, you know, more willing to just engage in the banter with her, because he actually like grows to respect her as, you know, as like in I don't know if that Doctor considers anyone an equal per se, but respect her as an equal effectively. So I think there's some interesting development for the Doctor that's caused by Romana, which you really don't see out of a lot of other companions. I also, you know, I like that. I mean, this is obviously subjective, but I mean, Mary Tam is one of the most conventionally attractive people ever to play a Doctor Who companion. And yet they don't trivialize her. Like, you know, she does look just absolutely glamorous in multiple episodes. Like her costuming is fantastic, but like it would be so easy to take a character like that and just have her be eye candy, you know, and some of the, you know, and we've talked about how Doctor Who was never as bad about that as people have said, but it would have been easy to go down that road with her, and yet they don't. I mean, she's gorgeous, but at the same time, she's there, she's doing her job. Like it's a very respectful portrayal that doesn't really rely on the attractiveness of the performer at all. And I really like that. I think it's, you know, it feels a little bit progressive for the show at the time. But I mean, at the same time, I can understand why she was a little frustrated with it, because like, even though there is that development over the course of the season, like she is still like firmly in the companion role, and the Doctor is still, you know, the lead, and he does need to rescue her, you know, frequently and so on. She's not portrayed as helpless or anything like that, but even though like she's on his level intellectually, they're not portrayed as, you know, being just on the same level as characters. Like the Doctor is still more of a driving force than she is. And granted, I don't know that it would be realistic to expect like a companion to be the Doctor's equal in a narrative sense, but that might be more what she was hoping for, and it didn't quite get there. But I mean, that's in the grand scheme of Doctor Who companions, that's a minor complaint. Like it's a good actor playing a good character who actually develops over the course of a season and clearly gains the respect of both the Doctor and Tom Baker as, you know, as the season goes on, and it works incredibly well. And I think it would have been just fine if she had played Romana for the character's entire existence. I mean, granted, I love Lala Ward too, but her leaving was a disappointment. Like it would have been very interesting to see how the show went forward with her, especially in the more humorous, you know, Douglas Adams era. But I really like her, and I wish she'd been around longer.
I do think it's a real shame that we've had two pretty rubbish companion departures on the bounce now. After how well Joe was done in The Green Death, and after how well Sarah was done in Hand of Fear, Leela just decided to stay on Gallifrey last minute, and now the first Romana doesn't even get any kind of goodbye. I wish, if they've managed to persuade her maybe to do a regeneration story, how good would it have been if we'd have had a regeneration story for Romana at the start of a season or even at the end of this? You know, if they knew she wasn't coming back, give her that regeneration. But instead we get sort of a comedy sequence at the start of Destiny of the Daleks, and then she's Lala Ward now, that's it. There's, no matter how you look at the first Romana, there's an awful lot of sort of missed potential, but I guess that's one of the perils of the way TV was produced in the late 70s.
It's interesting you say that about the regeneration. My wife sometimes watches these classic Doctor Who's over my shoulder a bit, and you know, she knew that Romana was a fellow Time Lord, and you know, I mentioned that like this was her, you know, the first Romana's last story, and she's like, "Oh wow!" So like, you know, she gets killed in this one effectively, like, you know, she's forced to regenerate, and I'm like, "No, in fact, you never see anything at all," and it's like, "Oh boy, yeah." I mean, huge missed opportunity, but of course, at the time, they didn't know she was leaving. I don't think so. Yeah.
Yeah, it's. I'd have liked to have seen that. I think about the impact that seeing the Master regenerate on the few occasions that we have has had. It could have been interesting to do that with Romana. It would have been rather good. And Armageddon Factor is full of points where she could feasibly have been, you know, killed or forced to regenerate somehow. Same with Destiny of the Daleks. There's definitely potential there for it to have happened, and it didn't, sadly, for various reasons. But that was season 16. That was the Key to Time. And it's been a really good season. There's no denying that, you know, there are four very, very solid stories in here, and the two that maybe don't live up to that are still nowhere near the worst we've seen or the worst we will see as we carry on with this. It's all in all, I think we've got some good Doctor Who in this one. So next up would be season 17. We did have a little chat just before we started recording this about how we were going to do this, because obviously we have Sharda. Do we stick to our broadcast and ignore its existence, or do we pick one of the many, 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 many versions of this story there is? And we've decided we are going to. We're going to go with the version from the Season 17 Blu-ray set. So if you're watching along with us, watching in between episodes in preparation or whatever, that's what we're going to go for when we talk about Sharda in about a month's time. But meanwhile, thank you very, very much for listening. We absolutely love doing these season-by-season episodes, and I can't believe we've got 16 seasons down now. So here's to the many more that are ahead of us. We're not even halfway there yet. But in the meantime, we'll be back for more Spodcasting very soon. Goodbye now.